In northern India, millions and millions of Hindu pilgrims have been gathering at Allahabad at a junction on the Ganges River. And that's our topic for this episode of The Good Life here on ABC Radio and on your pod with me, Noel Debien. The festival is called the Kumbh Mela, a vast ritual ceremony of bathing. It's so vast that it takes NASA satellites to capture the full scope of the gathering of people. And this year is the 12th year in the Hindu religious cycle, and it's the largest religious gathering on earth. Maybe 30 million people gather on the most auspicious day for the ritual bathing. An associate professor, Dr. Karma McLean from the University of New South Wales, has studied and written extensively on the Kumbh Mela. She's also bathed in the Ganges. The Good Life visited Dr. Karma to find out a little more about this festival, and in particular the sadhus, the Hindu holy men who are such a feature of this great gathering.
The processions of sadhus are only really formalised and allowed to take place on 3 days over the month of Magh. And so in between that you'll actually have much less compact observances going on around. Now the sadhus are of course in their camps during this time and they may bathe, but they don't go on these, you know, enormous and extremely impressive processions with great pomp and ceremony to the river to bathe all at once. On those mornings, they are given an enormous priority. There is an order. It's actually quite heavily scripted in many ways. Historically, they used to take elephants. They're no longer allowed to take elephants down there due to the crowds. But it really is an extraordinary thing to see. But it's not always there. Those are the busiest days, the most holy days of the festival. But the main focus of the activity is on actually bathing in the confluence of the two rivers, the Ganges and the Yamuna.
Is there a sort of a central organisation? I've found websites which say this is how it's organised, but having been in India, I find it hard to believe that it is in one sense.
Actually, this is the most extraordinary thing, really. It is very, very tightly run and managed by a government authority called the Mela Authority. There is a Mela every year in Allahabad in January, February. It just gets much bigger every 6 years and much, much bigger every 12 years. And that's why we have the full Kumbh, the Purn Kumbh, which we've just seen this year. So the amount of organisation that goes into that is absolutely extraordinary. There is, months beforehand, there is land-moving equipment that sculpts a bank that can actually bear the pilgrims. There is the downlaying of pipes, electricity cables. I mean, it's an enormously complex infrastructure. It has to be to manage this enormous influx of people coming in. And there is a government department entirely dedicated to this task alone, which receives substantial government and federal government funding.
How close could you get to the action as a person who is identifiably not an Indian?
Actually, you can get reasonably close. You can get very close. You could actually go and bathe yourself. This is not an exclusive festival in the same way that, say, Hajj. You can't go to Hajj if you're non-Muslim. Any person can participate in the festival, but what people do object to is having cameras pointed at them while they are, carrying out their bathing or their ritual.
I have noticed reports that there has been some resentment of foreign camera crews and BBC and ABC and whoever else trying to get in there and get their action.
Yeah, that's true. This happened at the last Mela in 2001 in particular, and things seem to be much more sensitive this time around. In 2001, there was a major controversy about the way in which a C4 crew represented the Mela as being a very exotic and in some ways erotic festival, which is not really how we would construe it. I mean, there is a lot of nudity at the festival. There is a sect of holy men who go naked as a way of displaying their spiritual advancement. And that was what the main controversy was about.
So what was happening was the crews were focusing on the nude men, the nude sadhus, the Naga sadhus who are coming through, and this has been misconstrued, and therefore the Hindus are offended. Is that what I'm hearing correctly?
Yes, that's true. There's a couple of layers of this. One is that there's, of course, enormous fascination with anybody who's naked these days. You know, people who are naked are, there's all kinds of associations about them being primitive. In the colonial period, people write about the Naga sadhus, these naked holy men, as being as naked as Adam. There's this association of the Mela being this, thing that's sunk in time and is pre-clothing and is primitive. And that kind of interpretation of it doesn't go down with contemporary Hindus as well, either now or then in the colonial period.
I was surprised when I saw a Naga sadhu myself. I mean, you read about them, I've seen photos, but when you see one,
you suddenly see in context, here's a nude person actually, not nude because they want to display, nude for other reasons. But for those of us who are not entirely clear about what this Naga Sadhu thing is, what are they? How do they fit within Hindu religion, and why are they at this festival? There's two questions there, I know.
There's stories of Naga Sadhus, the European accounts of Naga Sadhus that go back to the 1700s and even a little earlier. They're a fascinating band of Hindu holy men who group themselves in different groups. Not all of them are actually naked. The right to be naked is actually something one earns. Not everybody can simply just go naked. You're initiated into the ability to parade naked. And parading naked is a way of displaying that you've moved above, you've transcended physical, bodily, and obviously sexual desires, which is, of course, a considerable attainment, especially for anybody in an embodied, body, for lack of a rather scholarly term. But what they therefore represent is a very, very high form of spirituality, someone who has dislocated themselves from bodily sensation.
So for those who are Christians and who are used to the monastic ideal, the idea of asceticism, of self-denial, of attempting to, I suppose, train the body not to want things. We're looking at an ascetical practice. This nudity is, in fact, the opposite. It's not erotic. It's ascetical.
It is absolutely not erotic. It is a denial of eroticism, and a very, very purposeful one at that.
Now, there's another group there that are quieter that I've read of, the Kalpavasi, I think I pronounced it correctly. Now, who are these, and what are they doing?
The Kalpavasi is a pilgrim who has taken a vow to stay at the Kumbh site, or the Mela site, for the whole month of Magh. Magh sort of corresponds to January, February. And they take a vow to stay on the site for that whole month and to simplify their lives dramatically, to allow their life to be regulated by religious observances, by prayer, by bathing, by listening to holy men, give their talks, to having darshan, which means having an audience, if you like, of holy people, of gurus. It's basically a form of, in some ways, I guess you could describe it as a form of Lent.
The river. Now, rivers are of high significance within the Hindu system of meaning, and this is a festival which is all about washing, almost like baptismal, I suppose, in a way, but it's repeated, isn't it? Where and how do rivers fit into this sense of who Indians are and what Hindu religion is?
Rivers and water is extremely important within Hinduism, and we can relate this, of course, to India's heavily agrarian economy. Everyone is dependent on water, agrarian or not, actually. And so water is tremendously important for those reasons, and rivers that have such vast reserves of water come to carry a great significance as well. Almost all of the rivers, there's one exception, are related to female Hindu deities who are also worshipped in their own right. There is actually a network of rivers all across India, and in particular in the north, where of course the Kumbhs are mostly concentrated. Certainly the Kumbh Mela in Allahabad is part of the Ganga and its various tributaries. And so, if you like, you could think of these rivers as extending across what is effectively a map, and certainly in the past would have been an imagined map or a terrain of India.
A network, as it were, of rivers, of life connecting the whole country?
You could think of it that way, yes.
This year is a very big one. It's the biggest gathering of pilgrims on earth, as I understand it. But why this site? What's the mythology behind it?
This site is particularly important because it's a confluence of rivers. Actually, in Allahabad, there are three rivers that form the confluence.
Allahabad, it looks like a Muslim name to me. Is that its original name?
No. Many Hindus still think of it as Prayag. Prayag means the town where sacrifices are performed. It becomes known as Allahabad after Akbar, the great Mughal emperor, establishes a fort on the site. Very, very close, actually, to the Mela grounds, what is today's Mela grounds.
You did mention before in a country that's modernising, and we keep reading that India's economy is modernising, the nation is changing rapidly. How do millions and millions and millions of Indians put their jobs aside, Kalpavasi come and spend 2 months? How does an economy which is modernising even allow this many people to come together? How do they do it?
For a start, not everyone's a Kalpavasi. A Kalpavasi is the very, very determined pilgrims who do, walk away from their day-to-day lives. And it's something that people may only do once in a lifetime, to actually take Kalpavasi. The interesting thing about Allahabad, and one of the reasons why the Mela at Allahabad has always been historically quite big, is because it's at a very good time of year. India is an agrarian, or has always been really, a heavily agrarian economy. And this actually coincides with India's winter. And so there's not much that can be done on the land. And so, historically people could actually leave their land for, you know, a consolidated period of time to go to a big pilgrimage like the one in Allahabad.
Is the Mela such a thing that, you know, I could just go for a day or two and then come out, I perform the bathing and go out, or is it a long thing? I mean, how much time do you have to spend there?
You can go in and quite literally spend a day there. You can travel in one morning on the train, walk down, have your bath, get back on the train and go back home. Or you can stay for a few days, you can stay for up to the month. It really is, you know, dependent on how much, you know, time and importance that you may place on the actual observance. The other question you gesture towards is, you know, if India is modernising, why are millions of people still going to the Kumbh? And I guess I would question this idea. I mean, this is a Western concept that as we modernise, we become less religious. And even in the West, this has proven to be, in some ways, a little, you know, questionable. But it's certainly questionable in India. I mean, you know, there is, you know, all kinds of modernity going on in India. And in fact, that's really been, in the case of the Mela, adopted and used to make the Mela bigger. It hasn't actually seen a decline in the festival at all.
It is growing bigger. There's some reason why it's growing bigger. And you have spent a lot of time thinking about this, I think. Why do you think it's growing bigger?
This really starts under the British administration. You know, pilgrimages have historically always been very dangerous things, very dangerous undertakings. You had the difficulty of travelling there, which was historically, you know, by foot, across dangerous terrain where there might have been targets or bandits or any kind of hazard. So to go on a pilgrimage like this was always very dangerous. And so a pilgrim before leaving home would literally have to take care of all of their worldly affairs in case they died on route. The story, if you like, of the way in which the festival is managed by the British is one of making it progressively safer by controlling it more and more tightly to make it safer. They do it to try and prevent the Mela from being a source of danger to them. I mentioned a little earlier that the Mela is actually held on site next to Akbar's fort. The British took that fort over around about the turn of the 19th century, and they weren't exactly pleased with this enormous, you know, throng of people crowding around outside their fort, which became a very, very strategically important place for them in North India. And so they immediately became interested in controlling this festival and trying to limit the damage that it actually represented. You know, around about this time, one of the biggest dangers that the festival represented was that of epidemics. Cholera was a huge threat. It wasn't very well understood. No one knew how it was likely to spread.
Well, there was indeed a cholera outbreak in Allahabad historically, wasn't there a major one?
There's been several, and the problem of course is that people, they come to Allahabad, they pick up cholera and then they take it back with them to their homes, and so it was a way of spreading a disease. I mean, if you're looking for an effective way to spread a disease, that was one. So the British try to stop that mechanism. One way they try to do is through vaccination. And of course, you know, again, vaccination wasn't particularly well understood. There were mass vaccinations done with the same syringe. They were giving bloodborne diseases in the name of stopping, you know, a waterborne disease. So, you know, terrible errors made in you know, the attempt to try and make the Mela safer. But, you know, gradually, they regulate various aspects of the Mela. They regulate crowds. As we know from this year, unfortunately, the potential for a crowd to get out of control is very, very, you know, ever-present at the Mela, given the large numbers of people.
You mean you're referring to the stampede that occurred at the railway platform where people died this year?
Yeah, look, stampede, I wouldn't call it a stampede so much. I think it was a general panic when some infrastructure actually broke. Actually, they were very lucky that it didn't happen on site. In 1954, there was a dreadful tragedy where, you know, several hundred, if not more, people were killed as a result of a failure of crowd control.
We hear the same thing from the Hajj as well, wherever these huge numbers of people come, there's the potential for this, isn't there?
Absolutely, and the Hajj's response to this is to very, very carefully regulate the number of people coming in. You know, you have to get a visa to go to Hajj. You have to apply to the Hajj authorities to get to go. Allahabad doesn't have, the Mela doesn't have that kind of, you know, limitation on it yet. And I don't think it will. I mean, you know, the Hajj is a much shorter time frame, whereas, you know, really the Mela can go for up to 6 weeks.
It occurs to me that if a foreign power was occupying India, which it was with the British, the Mela is a huge gathering of people. The British see it as potentially a threat, anyway, this many people gathered together. How do the Indians see it, though? Is it part of their identity? And how did they feel about British attempts to control it?
British attempts to control the Mela were always, you know, contentious, especially when much harder measures were taken. There's an instance in 1924 where there's been a very, very heavy monsoon. The waters of the rivers are actually very, very fast and dangerous. And the British say, OK, we're going to ban bathing this year. And there's a mass protest. which is orchestrated by some leading nationalists in the town. In the end, of course, the British have to concede, okay, we'll allow bathing, but, you know, only within this very small area. So, yeah, you can see that that there were enormous attempts to control the Mela, and then sort of counter-attempts to resist that form of control.
How does the Mela figure in terms of how Indians define themselves in terms of identity? Does it have a role in that?
It is huge, and I think one of the, I mean, you know, you read several of the even colonial writers who go to the Mela in the late 19th century and early 20th. Everyone describes the Mela as being a cross-section of the Indian nation, you know, unfolding in front of them with, you know, people packed as dense as the eye can see.
What's the feeling like when you're there? I mean, what is it, a happy feeling? Is it a serious, or is there a mixture of what people are going through?
Oh, well, if you watch some of the footage of the holy men taking their bath, it's euphoric. You know, they're very excited, and anyway, it's a very uplifting atmosphere. You know, you are really struck by the experience that people are having in front of you at this festival. There is happiness. There is there are people who bathe with great solemnity, and there are people who bathe with great joy and abandon almost. So it's a mixed thing, but it's very upbeat. It's not a, I wouldn't think of it as being a kind of dour religious observance. It's a very upbeat, positive one. It's celebratory.
Have you done the bath?
You know, I did. I wondered. I used to wonder, you know, what it was like to bathe in the Ganga, because it's so cold, you know, it's freezing. And so at the Adkumbh Mela, I did go out with a friend on a boat, and I did swim, and it was cold, which makes you appreciate what these guys are doing even more. You know, the difficulty of bathing like that is really quite extraordinary.
Dr. Carmel McLean, thank you for being part of The Good Life.
My absolute pleasure.